Welcome to The Airwave, West Yorkshire Internal Medicine Teaching Collaborative Podcasts. In association with Airedale General Hospital and Bradford Royal Infirmary, a Chief Registrar Programme initiative.
I think that brings us on to a natural point. Let's talk about a couple of cases. Now, we mentioned ChatGPT. Myself and Dr. Greenwood went through a couple of cases of ChatGPT. I thought I'd use the opportunity to do a very similar thing again and mention a couple of interesting cases and talk about the patients and use it as an opportunity to learn and to discuss the cases between the two of us. How do you guys feel about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I've got a couple of cases to present. I'm going to start off with a case, and let's talk about it together. Let's not get too wrapped up in the A2E assessment. You can ask me any questions you like, but I'm going to put you, Dr. Haradine, Nurse Molly Johnson, CCOT sister, together on a case. Now, I'm not going to say anything beyond the stuff that's on the case. You can ask me some questions about it. Now, I want to see what you two think of the case. So what we have, a 65-year-old male on one of the medical wards has a history of hypertension, diabetes, and CKD. He's complaining of shortness of breath, chest pain, and palpitations for the last 2 hours. His blood pressure taken by the nurses is 210 over 120, so really high blood pressure. Heart rate is 180. His resp rate is 28 breaths per minute. His saturation is at 88% on room air. His physical exam shows a distressed gentleman who's diaphoretic, pale, crackly in both lungs. He's got loads of pitting edema to his legs and his JVP is wiggling his earlobe. His ECG taken by one of the bedside nurses shows atrial fibrillation with a rapid ventricular response, an ST depression in segments V4 to V6. What are you guys thinking about that patient? I haven't calculated the new score, but I think it's rather high.
I'd say in double figures, easy. If I walked on to that and I had that ECG in front of me, I don't know about you, Mona, but I think I'd be putting out a peri-arrest call.
I think so too.
I think I'd want a lot more bodies around.
Well, I think that a doctor should send the patient as soon as possible. I'm not sure if peri-arrest, for example, in Airedale, I don't think we call for peri-arrests as easily as other hospitals.
Fast bleeps to several cases. So Molly, you would be calling Moona straight away if someone rang you with that?
I would definitely be calling for a senior, but if this man looks as distressed as he is being presented, I'd be putting on a non-rebreathe immediately, and I think I'd be attaching the defib to him with that kind of blood pressure and heart rate.
So you're very quickly asking for Moona's help.
I would, yes.
So that's the thing about CCOT, is aware that this patient's very sick. Mm-hmm. And the nurses might not know how sick this patient is. You'd hope they put two and two together, but not always. Never make assumptions about what people will say. So Moona, approaching this patient, you know this patient's deathly unwell. We can gather that. What are the key bits of treatment you're wanting to offer here? And what investigations do you feel you need to make the next step?
Approaching the patient and seeing how acutely unwell he is, and usually start with acutely unwell patients with my ATE assessment. The patient does not seem to have a problem in A, but clearly has a problem in B in terms of having a really high resp rate.
Resp rate of 28. Yeah.
Oh, 28 and an O2 sat of 88%, but also a crackly lung sound.
Yes, which exactly is that.
Also, I would put a non-rebreathe mask, 15 litres of non-rebreathe mask, but also I'm thinking that the problem might be in C. My intervention for B would be the non-rebreathe mask, and in C, as the patient is really hypertensive, but also in fast AF, I'd start by maybe some bisoprolol for their fast AF, try and see if they can respond to that, but although I know that they won't be responding to it pretty fast, I would also try and, I'd do something about the blood pressure as well.
It's a bit of a thinker, Joe. Do you want me to start talk through my theory? We're a team now. So,
can I just ask one question just because
you're curious.
I'm curious, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I do know when you've got someone with that kind of fast AF, but they've got low blood pressure, you would go through the ALS algorithm, wouldn't you? Would you still do the same approach with someone with who is hypertensive?
I should mention Molly is also ALS certified. Big tick there.
Okay.
So, I think this is a really interesting question. So, Moona, with that type of history, are you speaking to me or are you doing the first bits of management on your own?
I think that this patient does need senior input. He is acutely unwell. but also before senior input, I would like to get enough information about the patient before calling someone to come and see him.
What further information do you feel you need?
I'm not really sure about his urine output, especially knowing that he's a CKD patient in the background.
If I find out if your urine output's tailed off over the last 6 hours?
Tailed off?
Yeah.
Okay. I would ask for I'd want a bladder scan at some point as well to
a bladder scan's got 10 mils of urine.
Okay. So I'm thinking this might be also, I'd need to take blood to see as well. And
I've got some plans if you'd like to hear them.
Oh, okay. That's
pretty fast. I've got a troponin of 1200, the 1200. Okay. I've got BMP of 900. Now, for those who aren't familiar with BMP, that's high, but it's high but not silly high. Creatinine is currently 320, normal being around 100. Yep, so creatinine is raised. Vischat for creatinine is normally around 150 to 200, so it's elevated for him. Potassium is 5.6. The glucose is 15. That's all the information I've got for you.
Okay.
That's all the information that ChatGPT will tell them.
Yeah. So this patient is in AKI on CKD, but also has a high trop and high BNP, which is also deviating our thoughts into heart failure and could be heart failure after an ischemic event.
So what are you thinking about?
Also an AF.
So would you want to escalate at this point?
I would like to escalate it, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that the patient needs escalation and even may need Molly said, a crash call, just because this patient is not only acutely unwell but could deteriorate really fast.
Is there any particular treatment that you think is coming next? So let's say we put a crash call out, so we've pressed our 4.2s and told him about the adult crash call. Remember, when you put a crash call out, it goes out as normal, but peri-arrest, arrest, we still want all the people there. You'll get all the right people.
Yeah.
So don't worry about putting a arrest call out. If you're not sure, put it out. Better to have put one out and to realise it wasn't required 5 minutes down the line than to not put one out and then realise you needed one 5 minutes ago. So we put a crash call out. What do you think is next for this patient? What sort of treatments do you think we should be preparing for? You've mentioned about giving some rate-controlling medications for the atrial fibrillation. Talk a little bit about that blood pressure. Is there anything else you want to do?
Yeah, I'm thinking this patient might also be overloaded in terms of the crackly lung sounds, the low saturations, the high blood pressure, the low urine output. All of this is the high JVP as well. We might be needing to give imidazoline as well pretty fast, but also this patient looks like they are having heart failure. Just because the trop is really high, I'm also thinking it's secondary to an ischemic event.
What are you wanting from a CCOT perspective, Molly? What are you thinking next? You put a crash call out now. Where's your next step? She said you put the defibrillator pads on.
I would, with that kind of heart rate, just because, like Mona said earlier, that patient is at a massive risk of a rapid deterioration, i.e. his heart could just stop at any point. And if it's an electrical event, you've already got the precursor there to try and fix it. So that's one thing I would be doing. I don't think fluids would be the right answer, which is one thing that we can intervene with. So I wouldn't be giving fluids. I think my primary role in this situation would be to stay with the patient and try and intervene if there is nobody with any sort of skill set. Like I said, I do have ALS certification, so if needs be, I would be able to say, if the patient arrests, start compressions and
go
through the rest of it, yeah.
So, is there anything else about ALS that might prompt you about what to do next in this case? I'm going fishing here, but see.
with this particular patient, so with patients who are primarily who have cardiac problems, we are a little bit hands tied because the majority of the interventions are medical interventions. Like I said earlier, we are first and foremost, we are nurses. Things like Mona says, starting antihypertensives or starting beta blockers and whatnot, we can't actually initiate. It's not permitted. So my role there would be to just do what is necessary and what is instructed by the medical staff. And I can initiate those drugs with the instruction and a prescription, absolutely. So if needs be, I could start labetalol, or I could give oral drugs or whatever is needed. But yeah, we do unfortunately have a little bit of blockages when it comes to cardiac patients.
So shall I give you my two pence on this case, because I think it's quite an interesting case, isn't it? And actually, this is something I've come across. You come across this every now and then, the patient with atrial fibrillation who becomes really unwell. And actually, the key thing here, as Molly mentioned, is your ALS algorithm. So actually, this patient through the tachycardic algorithm would be in heart failure, which is a criteria for cardioversion, and would also be in a degree of myocardial ischemia reflected by the ST depression. So actually, my next step would be cardioverting this patient. Interesting thought. So there's an interesting, I entirely agree with what Muna said about the need to rate control and offload. And that's certainly the next step in this case. So we put the oxygen on. So we give our oxygen to correct that problem. Fundamentally, the respiratory rate's probably been driven by some degree of cardiac failure, probably driven by the atrial fibrillation. So actually what we're looking for there is to offload. There's a couple of different mechanisms to do that. Controlling the rate. This is all rate related in all likelihood. So we fix the rate, we probably fix everything else. So I agree, bisoprolol rate control. I would probably go for IV metoprolol, because IV metoprolol is much faster. Bisoprolol's got about half an hour to an hour. This patient probably doesn't have half an hour to an hour. So IV metoprolol, have you ever used IV metoprolol, Muna?
I haven't actually used it myself, and I don't think it is. It can be used on the wards. I think it has to be used in ITU, I think, or
CCU
as well,
So, but in this case, I won't worry too much. Even if we're on the ward, I think this is a patient who's so sick it would justify using on a ward. I'd be trying to get this patient to CCU initially because of that high heart rate. But IV metoprolol is actually very easy to use. So that rate of bisoprolol, that dose of bisoprolol, be it 2.55 or 10, is just the same dose given an IV metoprolol. The conversion rate is essentially the same. So if you were going to give 2.5 dose of bisoprolol, give 2.5 metoprolol, and it works in about 2 to 3 minutes. Doesn't last as long. Falls out of circulation in about half an hour. Very good test if someone's going to be beta blockade responsive, which is a really good start. Much use of IVGTN? Moon, have you seen IVGTN used much?
Yeah, I have, but I think it also is a little bit too above. IVGTN is usually not used on the wards either.
So there's an environment problem here, isn't there? Fundamentally, there's a lot of the stuff we'd like to do, but we can't probably do on the medical floor.
But if I could just interject, just because I'm on this one. In this kind of situation, you're talking about drugs, like we've said, these drugs are level 2 or 3 environment needed. However, you've got a really acutely unwell patient who needs intervention now. And one of the perks of having someone who's used to these drugs, I've used IV metoprolol, I've used IVGTN, we are allowed to monitor these patients, well, as long as we've got the monitor in, like if we've got the defib, or we've got a 12 lead, or we've got a 5 lead monitor, as long as we've got some sort of monitoring, we are allowed to monitor these patients and care for them. So I would be glued to that patient until they're in the care environment they need.
So would you be happy with us giving, me and Muna giving IV metoprolol on the ward if you were sat watching this patient?
As long as he didn't stay there, yeah. So we have to stay with the patient to maintain their safety, because the one thing we can't do is delay life-saving treatment. So that's one of the things that our team comes in handy for. Like I say, I've had numerous times where I've had to set up an IV on the ward and stay with them for hours while they receive that treatment as early as possible before they get to where they need to be. So the same thing would apply here. I am happy monitoring somebody on inotropes on a ward until they get to the care environment.
Yeah. So talking a little bit more about a case, I mean, you mentioned about the IV furosemide, IV GTN, say if we're giving IV GTN, that's a CCU drug. IV furosemide, we see IV furosemide on a ward, don't we?
Definitely, reasonably
regularly, and it's a good drug. It takes half an hour to an hour again for it to really work. And the good thing about GTN is if GTN is going to work, it works in about 5 to 10 minutes. As soon as you get through the dead space on the cannula, which is the only thing to mention, is don't put big greys and start GTN. GTN infusions run incredibly slowly. But don't push GTN. That's a good idea. But if you, I can't remember the, I think it's something like milliliters per hour. Mm-hmm. It's like 3 to 4 milliliters. So for dead space on a cannula is about 2 to 3 mils. You've got to be careful about starting IV GTN because it may not actually get into the system for a while.
I think it's about half a mil. Don't forget your cannula's tiny in the...
They put a big rate.
Diameter, and it's very, very small. It's not.
But if we can potentially delay treatments, it's a useful thing to think about. And then, say, some of those other treatments that we've mentioned. This patient's quite sick, and I think they would meet all the criteria to go to either CCU or maybe in intensive care. As a CCOT nurse, what would make you worry that would make you take this patient to ICU, or at least speak to the ICU team on the medical team's behalf?
Well, I'd like to think they'd show up with the crash call, but if I had to...
They're still sat here drinking their coffee.
My primary concerns would be the hearts and the saturations. My worry would be that that patient would arrest at any point because it's not a sustainable rhythm. And they would have, and with a rest rate like that as well, they would get very tired very fast. So my worry would be they would either arrest or possibly even have a stroke. So I would want interventions for the heart and lungs primarily.
Are there any other reflections, Moon, about anything else you would do with this case? Any other kind of points that you would focus on?
I think I agree with Molly that the saturations and, well, the clear overload also and the really high blood pressure and heart rate are the three things that I'm looking into. And I think the fast AF and just offloading the patient are the things that are going to make him feel rapidly better as they've rapidly deteriorated him. Once we've dealt with these three problems, I think I'd be less worried about the patient. But for now, this is what's worrying me.
And so this is an acutely unwell patient, isn't it? And this patient needs much more care and needs much more optimization. And certainly with ECG changes, they need their dual antiplatelets, don't they? So they'll need back managing. If they've got a new AF, they're going to need potentially starting anticoagulation, depending on their CHA2DS2-VASc score. If they've got worsening CKD and we're giving furosemide, are we sure we know what the cause of the AKI is? There's so many more questions here, aren't there? But in reality, what we're doing is focusing on the key bits to keep that patient alive and well until we can optimize the underlying medical problem to then spend a bit more time fixing the bits and pieces. But I think this patient could go to intensive care, potentially, and depending on some of those other numbers. But these patients can get better quite quickly, in my experience.
Well, the one key question is, what's his escalation as well?
No, we can talk about that on the next case.
That's one of my favourite questions to ask.
So there we are. So let's move on to our second case. And our second case is a bit more familiar ground as a medical SHO. What I'm going to say this time, Moon, is you're the first doctor seeing this patient. So your nurses have rung you up and told you there's an 85-year-old female called Doris. She has a history of dementia, COPD and osteoporosis. She's confused, very confused, wandering around the ward, seems really rather unwell. She's got a fever, temperature of 39, and a cough that she's had for the last 2 to 3 days. She's been in hospital for about 2 months waiting for a social care bed. Heard that story before. Physical exam finds you a very confused lady who's lethargic, very short of breath. She's wheezy, crackly. Her breath sounds to the right lower lobe are reduced, and the percussion notes to the right lower lobe is dull. There's decreased air entry in that right lower lobe. She's not cyanosed or clubbed. She's not particularly edematous. You've done a chest x-ray remotely. Mm-hmm. You asked for chest x-ray based on the reporting, and the chest x-ray shows a very clear right lower lobe consolidation. She's got history of COPD, and there is hyperinflation consistent with what there's been previously. White cell count is elevated, CRP is 150, a lactate is 4, and the ABG shows that she's got a pH of 7.28 and a CO2 of 7.5. The PO2's in range to make her SATs 88% and 92%. What are you thinking about this patient? No, Molly's done the ABG. She's done her ABG course, and she's been able to hand that to you before she goes off to see another patient. What are you thinking?
I am thinking that this might be an exacerbation of COPD secondary to an infection. But regardless, I think that when you get told about a patient, and even though sometimes the problem might be clear, we should also go to 80. And I think that this is really important for the F1s and F2s that are listening to us in this podcast. And it's usually sometimes scary when you hear an acutely unwell patient or someone that you don't know what's going on with them. And I think going back to basics is the most important step. So in terms of going back to basics, I'm happy about this patient A does not seem to have any problems, but this patient B, you said she's in range, right? Her O2 sats are in range.
So she's on a 4-liter nasal cannula. Her sats are currently 88%. We've verified that with the ABG. Her OBS, they've been taken, blood pressure is 90 over 60. Her heart rate's 110. Her respirator is 32.
Yeah, these are worrying me in terms of if this patient is septic. Now, I'm now knowing that the patient does have a consolidation. And in terms of sepsis, I'd start with my sepsis 6, where I would give fluids, give broad spectrum antibiotics until we know what the positive agent is, making sure we have their lactate, which is already high, checking their urine output, and I always...
Okay, you've got Seacon nurse here who can tell you what the rest of the buffalo is. So we're taking our blood cultures, our urine output, fluids that we've given, antibiotics that we've given, lactate that we've given, taken, and oxygen levels, that we've prescribed. Now, you see, I'm worth my weight in gold as a medical registrar.
Absolutely.
And then, so this patient is clearly, she's confused, probably of delirium secondary to the infection. And so I think that antibiotics, fluid resuscitation are one of the most important steps, as well as making sure that she's still in a range of her scale 2 oxygen O2 sats, and making sure that we've taken blood cultures so we can switch the patient into the right antibiotics when we get the culture results back. But also, well,
what do you make about the CO2? So we've got a CO2 that's high, and we've got bicarb is on the lower side. So the bicarb is not a chronic type bicarb. So bicarb's in normal range, but the CO2 is 7.5. And that pH is 7.28. What's that making you think, Muna?
That is also making me worry about an exacerbation of her COPD in terms of this CO2. And I think this patient also needs to be given nebulizers, maybe some salbutamol and epitropium. Well,
and I've been asking, the nurse shows up and starts setting all that up for you. So Molly's going to go run off and get the nebulizers and set the nebulizers up. Is there any kit you'd like her to bring with her?
Any kit, you said?
Is it maybe, do you want her to bring the NIV machine down just in case?
Yeah, in case this patient is in need of an NIV machine. I think that at the minute, I don't think the patient is in need of NIV. I think that this patient may deteriorate to be needing NIV, may rapidly deteriorate to need it. What do you think, Molly?
What are you thinking about? So when it comes to managing this potential NIV situation, what are you looking for? When are you repeating that gas, and what are you doing in between?
I think that we'll be giving the nebulizers and checking the gas and ABGs in between. So maybe hourly ABGs would be beneficial to check if the patient is improving. And if they're not improving, we might need an IV. Yeah, and I think at some point I will have to escalate this to my senior doctor.
So we've repeated that ABG now. So let's say we've given half an hour, given max medical treatment. You've started all those nebulizers, you've run ridiculous amounts of salbutamol, and the patient's still really wheezy, they're still looking unwell, they're still tachypneic, still dyspneic, looking unwell. The repeat ABGs come back, and I've got some bad news for you. You've got the NIV machine. Is that something you're ready to do on a ward?
Always. As long as I've got my can of Coke.
So, for you as a CCOT nurse, is it difficult providing NIV on a ward?
There are multiple factors to consider. Starting NIV, as a rule, is usually straightforward, but on a ward, there are obstacles, i.e. how much bed space have you got to work with? Is your patient confused? Have you got other patients around? Because they do like to intervene and be a bit nosy. So you've not got the protected bed space that you'd have in a high dependency or an intensive care unit. So we do have to factor those into consideration. However, fundamentally, the patient needs the treatment, so you just have to make it work. So I tend to I tend to have a little bit of a chunk of the ward or the bay. I will just move a bunch of furniture around, put that NIV machine in. I'll get myself a chair and some paper, and then that is my little ICU bed for however long it takes to get the patient to an area of safety.
Yeah, I think it's important, as Muna was just saying, it's important that in these patients, so we perform that first ABG, that ABG is concerning, but we're providing max medical treatment for at least half an hour to really optimise that patient as well as possible. And if that ABG is still acidotic, the CO2 is still high, if there's anything that makes me worry on that gas, the respiratory function is still poor, and we're still in a decompensated type 2 respiratory failure. And unfortunately, the only solution really is NIV at that point. And are you happy managing the machine and up-titrating the machine as required?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All part of the job. And that's ultimately, I think, the treatment for the patient here. As Moon has just said, it's really important that you get the initial bits of antibiotics in, you're providing that initial bit of treatment, be that with fluids, what have you. But fundamentally, here we really have a B problem, a respiratory problem. The lactate's high, but that's probably reflecting someone who's acutely unwell. And they need that sepsis 6 management, absolutely need that sepsis 6 management. But in reality, the other thing that we need here is NIV. We need respiratory support. And then when you're sitting with that patient, you're just waiting for that bed.
We are waiting for the bed. In that period of time, I would be monitoring them like I would be on an ICU. So I tend to make my own little OBS chart. I'll write down all of the numbers that's on the NIV, as well as being doing repeat OBS. I'll be managing the patient, because sometimes there is a tolerance factor. Can the patient actually tolerate the therapy? Do we have to take it on and off? Ideally, we like to have the mask on at all times so that the optimum treatment is provided. So that's why they need one-to-one monitoring, because there are so many things that you have to monitor about that one patient when NIV is taken in.
And we know that patient's confused, wandering around the ward. Does that make NIV more difficult for you in a ward setting?
It can be, definitely, because if you've got a patient who's wandering around confused, there could be an element of agitation. Mm. It wouldn't be a surprise to me if this patient was so confused that she became combative, in which case NIV might become a problem. And if she is absolutely for NIV, you know, we can touch upon escalation at a different point, but if she's absolutely for NIV, you might have to factor things in. Like giving a bit of sedation so that we can actually give that treatment, but you don't want to over sedate, because then NIV becomes a contraindication.
It's chasing your tail, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's a lot of
starting IV to control agitation, but then having to give something to control the agitation, it's a nasty cycle to get caught in.
Bit of a rock and a hard place sometimes.
And with this patient, so we mentioned this patient's got a history of dementia, they've evidently got some COPD. And they may well have, at the age of 85, other associated medical comorbidities. Do you have an issue being involved with these patients on a ward?
No issues. It's more just the case of, would they be able to tolerate it? That would probably be one of my biggest concerns, is are they actually able to tolerate having such a tight-fitting mask on that blows massive amounts of air in their face?
So it's more holistic?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think that's been a really interesting case. I think it's important too. Talk about a key point here. I think from my perspective, you've got a patient who's acutely unwell. It's about that key treatment. It's about using NIV. And if I need to start NIV on a treatment on the ward, it's great to know, but I've got a nursing team there that can support that. RQ beds and ICU beds can be hard to get, can't they? And knowing I've got a nurse that can provide that level of support there is really useful. And in regard to the escalation discussion decisions, is that something you're comfortable being involved with?
As an ICU nurse, it is something that we have frequent involvement in. It's not uncommon for us to come across patients who are sadly very, very unwell, but resuscitation can be a very aggressive form of treatment in various different ways. So if the patient is elderly, they're frail, they've got comorbidities that wouldn't be compatible with, say, for example, CPR, it's not always fair to the patient, or it might not be in their best interest. So as a medical registrar, you guys have that authority to dictate if that's, you know, something the patient should have. But I, as a nurse, my role there is to support the patient.
And advocate for the patient.
Yeah, if it's something that is a conversation that can be quite traumatizing for them. So we are quite literally with a holding hand there to give them a bit of emotional reassurance and tell them that we will do everything we absolutely can. So I have been involved in quite a few resuscitation conversations.
And it's important to note as well, this is all happening in the landscape of Martha's Rule, which is being implemented into a variety of different trusts throughout the UK about 24/7 access to rapid review from CCOT teams, which won't necessarily always involve nursing level teams and will not necessarily mean that nursing teams are making decisions about escalation statuses, but it's more a discussion that then has to take place between a medical or surgical team and an intensive care team if there is a desire for potential escalation of care. But it's a difficult space to navigate, but it's not how the CCOT team, a majority of centres, which is mainly nursing-based, is going to be utilised. It's an important separation to make. But you're happy to be involved in some of those discussions if required?
I am, yeah. It's not something that's foreign to me, and unfortunately it's something we come across quite a lot, especially being sometimes we are the first ones called to a deteriorating patient. So sometimes these conversations do come up because sometimes there are family there as well who want to go against these things, and they can be tricky situations to navigate. So like I say, we're primarily there to support the family and the patient. So that's exactly what we tend to provide.
They're happy to be involved in those discussions with the doctors in terms of being there when doctors break bad news as well?
Absolutely. As I have had, you know, no disrespect to anyone from before, I have had some people who can put it very bluntly and the patients are a bit shell-shocked. Mm. So we tend to be a bit of a cushion for the patient to bounce off of later.
Yeah. So I think that's been a really good conversation. I want to thank you both for your time. I think it's been a really useful and engaging discussion. I think talking about acutely unwell patients is really important and a really important part of our job. So I want to thank you, Muna and Molly, for your time. And if you want to say goodbye.
Bye. Thank you, Mark, for this podcast again. And we hope everyone enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Airwave. We hope you enjoyed our podcast and learned something new. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing to our podcast on your favourite platform and look out for our content on YouTube.
So everyone quiet, I'm going to introduce myself about an hour into the podcast and then I'll stick it back in at the start because I realised I did not introduce myself at all. So hello, fuck's sake, that's not good. Shut up.
Maybe do it
while we're not here. No, it's weird, there's pressure. So, my name's... So my name's Dr. Mark Johnson. I'm the Chief Registrar at Airedale General Hospital. I'm the Faculty Lead of the Airwave podcast. And I'm... I don't need to say
I'm
dying. Right, screw it. Right, move on from that. Right, hey.
Okay.
Okay, ready? Right,
okay,
ready. This is the goodbye bit now. This is the goodbye bit. I guess it's going to take forever.
Okay. Though.